We are delighted to have United States Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut in office since 2013, who served in the House since 2007. Hey, you know, Chris, when I first asked you whether you were willing to run for president, you said no, you were too young. Are you older now?
I am technically old enough now, but there are other impediments in my way. Two much younger Murphys, in particular, the 8-year-old and the 5-year-old.
Well, I can't see any real impediments in
no,
your
we'll
way.
Talk to them.
I've decided you should be the president, or at very, very least, the vice president. So you can't tell me you don't wake up in the middle of the night sometime and think about the being the president of the United States. People love you, you know.
I think there certainly is a popular conception that every U.S. senator thinks of themselves as a future president. But I love this job. I mean, I can't believe that I get to wake up every day and be the United States senator for this state that's meant so much to me and my family. And I've got a re-election race in 2018 that, if I'm spending time thinking about politics and not policy, that's what I'm focused on.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the president's Afghanistan address. What do you make of it?
Well, there's not that much there. It seems as if it's basically a continuation of President Obama's policy. Maybe there'll be a few thousand more troops, but certainly not enough to tip the balance between the Afghan forces and the Taliban. There's some complicated diplomacy involved in Afghanistan. There has been since the start, and Trump acknowledged that in his speech. The Pakistanis have been, and oftentimes completely complicit with the Taliban, engaging in an almost command and control relationship over the very forces that the United States and the Afghan army are fighting. India is a big player there as well, which the president acknowledged. Problem is, the president doesn't have anybody in or around him that has a diplomatic experience in that region or, frankly, anywhere in the world. He's handed this policy over to the generals, and Afghanistan is not a military problem. It is a political problem. The Taliban has taken root in big parts of that country because governance sucks, because the Afghan government is corrupt. It's been corrupt since we stood it up in 2002, and it can't get better by the presence of U.S. military. It'll only get better if we put people on the ground there who have experience in trying to make the rule of law stick in complicated places like Afghanistan. So with no diplomats, it's really hard to make any strategy work in Afghanistan.
So I guess it should be remembered that the Pakistanis who you just referenced, I think, were hiding Osama bin Laden, weren't they?
Well, Osama bin Laden was hiding inside Pakistan. I don't think people know whether the Pakistanis knew about it. But what we do know is that the ISI, which is their sort of military intelligence unit, was for a long time essentially directing the Taliban's activities inside Afghanistan, directing attacks against the United States. So there has been very direct involvement from the Pakistanis in Afghanistan to the detriment of the United States. What was missing from the speech last night, Alan, was any mention of Russia. Russia is deeply involved right now in arming and standing up the Taliban because they see it as a wedge, a fulcrum point between the United States and our allies there. And yet, once again, Russia got off scot-free in the president's speech. We heard a lot about Pakistan's support for the Taliban. We heard nothing about Russia's support for the Taliban.
Okay, so that goes to a question, obviously, about motive. Do you think this has to do with the fact that what Mueller's looking into the Trump connection to the Russians?
If the Russians were pulling the strings of the Trump administration's foreign policy, this is how it would go. You'd have a speech about Afghanistan that doesn't mention Russia. You would have a wholesale shutdown of the Department of State, which has been a big thorn in the side of Russia, frankly, going all the way back to the Cold War era. You would have the United States outsource Middle Eastern questions to the Russians, as we effectively have done inside Syria, by standing down from the political process and putting Russia in charge. I just think ultimately there's got to be some fire beneath all of this smoke, and it certainly looks as if Russia's getting everything they want from U.S. foreign policy right now.
You referenced the generals before. I find this really fascinating. Political scientist, I've looked at this kind of thing. You know, the United States is distinct among many countries in this world because we keep this relationship between the executive and the general separate. Now, I'm not going to kid you. I don't like Donald Trump, and I don't like what he does. And I always got the generals in there. And the generals, it seems to me, you know, are going to make him a better president in terms of moderating his very erratic behavior. But then my question becomes, what about the next general after these guys?
Well, when you put the military as front and center in foreign policy, you're going to get this problem of, you know, every single thing sticking up looking like a nail because all you have is a hammer. The U.S. military are full of very, very smart men and women, but they've made some horrible, egregious strategic mistakes in the last 15 years. They convinced President Bush that they could stabilize a country, Iraq, with shock and awe, not understanding the fact that that shock and awe campaign would alienate the population to give rise to an extremist movement that we are still dealing with today. And, you know, going, you know, back decades and decades, the military often pushes executives into confrontations which could be better handled through diplomacy. Cuban Missile Crisis being a perfect example for anybody that's read 13 Days. So without any real high-level experienced diplomats in the White House, the fear is that Afghanistan, North Korea, Syria are all going to be viewed purely as military problems where they are actually political and economic problems. So, yeah, I like the fact that there's a couple smart generals that may stop Trump from pressing the button if he gets pissed off about something that another world leader does. But I would really love to have some experienced diplomats around him who understand the true nature of these problems.
I got 2 minutes for you on North Korea. If you were the president, I know you say you're not running, but if you were the president, what would you do about North Korea?
Well, I haven't been as tough on him on North Korea as others have been because he's not wrong to make Kim Jong-un understand very clearly that if he does launch a weapon, if he does threaten the United States or our allies, we will engage in a disproportional response, and we have the capability to do that. That is part of the strategy, because if you believe that the North Koreans are rational, then they understand that if they ever were to launch a weapon, that would result in the obliteration of the regime. The problem is he's missing the other half of the strategy, which, coming back to this issue we were talking about before, is a diplomatic strategy. We need to apply economic sanctions. We need to work with the Chinese in a way that perhaps unwinds this crisis without military hostilities. And once again, he has no idea on how to do that, no personnel in place to do it, and no relationships with allies that could end up having a sanctions regime being built like the one we did against Iran. So the tough talk was obviously ham-handed. It was over the top. But it's not a fundamentally wrong part of a broader strategy.
It's always wonderful to talk to our friend, United States Senator Chris Murphy. I knew him when. And Chris, you said you'd come back after you were in the Senate, and you have. You're a man of your word, and we all love you for it. Thanks so much for doing it.
Thanks.